you're my love of yesteryear.
Howdy, folks.
Yes, it is your old friend Singing Sam. So let's just settle back and reminisce a bit. What do you say, huh?
With a nostalgic nod toward the Atwater Kent, we now present Same Time, Same Station, a chronicle of broadcasting's first half century.
Return with us now to those thrilling days of yesteryear. From out of the past come the thundering hoofbeats of
that Brewster boy.
S-P-A-R-K-I-T-S for breakfast.
Did you hear about the door that didn't behave itself?
No, Joey. What about the door that didn't behave itself?
It got in a jam. Get it, Mark?
Oh, that's Joey. That's Brewster boy. Brought to you each Wednesday at this time by Quaker Wheat Sparkies and Quaker Rice Sparkies. Did you spark up with Sparkies at breakfast this morning? That's the great new breakfast idea that's winning the country. Because a delicious breakfast of Sparkies gives you a bonus of two highly important healthful elements widely lacking in American foods. So spark up with Sparkies at breakfast every day.
Tonight, that Brewster boy, Eddie Firestone, remembers radio. In a few minutes, our guest. But first,
this is the story of an average American family, the Brewsters. You'll find people like Mom, Dad, Nancy, and Joey Brewster in every town in this country of ours. Yes, that's right. You'll even find boys like Joey in every town, because Joey's problems are universal, especially when he's in love, as he appears to be this evening. Right now, a pert, pretty Evelyn White and an adoring Joey are in the White's hallway, ready to leave. And Joey is saying...
Evelyn.
Hello, Joey. How long have I kept you waiting?
15 minutes, Evelyn.
15 minutes? Well, I guess that's enough. Come on, let's blow.
Okay. It's a nice evening, isn't it?
I never discuss the weather. Military secret.
Evelyn?
Yes, Joey?
You...
Yes, Joey?
I better not say it.
Oh. You're terribly honorable, aren't you, Joey?
Do you think so?
Especially where Malcolm's concerned.
Well, he's my friend. Evelyn.
Yes, Joey?
Your hair. You've got...
Yes, Joey?
You've got hair.
My goodness, I should think so.
Yeah. Well, here we are. There he is.
Well, salutations, Evelyn.
Hello, Malcolm.
Here she is, Malcolm.
Thanks, Joey. Yes, here she is. A picture of exquisite comeliness.
Oh, Malcolm, you're so cute.
Thanks a lot, Joey. You're a true friend.
Yeah. Evelyn.
Yes, Joey. Yes, Joey.
Goodbye, Evelyn.
Goodbye, Joey. Goodbye. Come on, Evelyn.
Goodbye, Joey.
Goodbye. Goodbye,
Sugarpuss. You mean it happens every night, Honey Bun?
Yes, Phil. Every night at 8 o'clock, Joey leaves the house all dressed up as though he has a date.
All dressed up in my best tie.
Mm-hmm. And then every night at 8:30, Joey comes back home with a woebegone look, says goodnight, and goes up to bed.
And this happens every night.
Well, it's happened every night this week. Right, Mother?
Oh, why must some women be so unreasonable?
Mother, we're talking about Joey.
We were all getting along so well in our club, and then this sabotage.
Which club is that, Mother?
The Every Other Tuesday Evening Literary Society.
The Every Other Tuesday Evening Literary Society.
Yes, Phil.
Well, what's happened, Mother?
Well, we were about to elect officers, and suddenly we discovered that the club is divided into two factions. Mrs. White has her following.
And they want to elect her chairman.
And Mrs. Camel has her following.
And they want to elect her chairman.
Now Mrs. White's faction is threatening to withdraw from the club.
Comes the revolution.
Mrs. White says they're going to form their own club.
Oh, they are?
The Every Other Tuesday Evening Literary Society.
The Every Other Tuesday Evening Literary Society.
Well, which one's best fitted for the job?
Well, Mrs. White claims she ought to be chairman of the Every Other Tuesday Evening Literary Society because when she was a little girl, she sat on Longfellow's knee.
Wouldn't that make her pretty old?
Well, I guess she didn't sit on Longfellow's knee, but her mother did, and she used to sit on her mother's knee, so she practically sat on Longfellow's knee.
Oh. Remote control.
Yes, Phil.
Well, whose knee did Mrs. Campbell sit on?
What?
What's Mrs. Camel's claim to literary fame, Mother?
Why, her maiden name is Browning.
Oh, is she related to the poet Robert Browning?
Well, she could be.
Oh. Well, I think I heard Joey come in. What time is it, Phil?
8:30.
Then it's Joey.
Home from his half-hour date.
I'm going to talk to Joey. I want to find out about that.
Oh, why are some women so unreasonable?
Oh, when you get the answer to that, Mrs. Brewster, let me know.
Phil!
Joey! Joey, is that you?
Hello, Dad.
You have a date, son?
Well, sort of.
You've had sort of a date every evening now for a week. Who is she?
Evelyn.
Evelyn? I thought you were through with Evelyn.
Well, I thought so too, Dad, before it happened.
Before what happened?
You see, Dad, Evelyn happened to drop a book in the hall.
Yes?
And I happened to be walking by and we both happened to pick it up.
Yes, go on.
Then when we stood up, we happened to look into each other's eyes, and that's when it happened.
When you looked into each other's eyes?
Yeah, Dad. It happened all over again.
Love?
Yes, sir.
To both of you?
That's the trouble, Dad. It just happened to me.
Oh.
Every night at 8 o'clock, I take Evelyn to the corner drugstore.
To the corner drugstore?
She meets Malcolm there.
Malcolm?
You know, Dad, the boy with the glasses, the boy with the brains, the boy with the vocabulary.
Is that just one boy?
Yeah, Malcolm Campbell. You see, Evelyn's mother, Mrs. White, isn't speaking to Malcolm's mother, Mrs. Campbell.
Oh, yes, of course. The Every Other Tuesday Evening Literary Society.
Yeah, Malcolm and Evelyn aren't supposed to see each other anymore. And that's where I come in.
Well, but Joey, what about Minerva? Aren't you dating her?
Oh, Dad, Minerva's so tall.
Now, Joey.
Well, when you have a date with Minerva, it's sort of like having a date with a stepladder.
Now, Joey, you're exaggerating.
Well, she's taller than I am.
Well, now, son.
She's taller than I am, Dad. Even when she sits down, she's taller than I am.
Joey, she's no taller than your mother was at that age. And look at your mother now.
Oh, maybe so. But Minerva isn't my mother.
Oh, Joey.
Jeepers, Dad, a fella likes to... Well, he likes to look into a girl's eyes.
Well, can't you look into Minerva's eyes?
Yes, sir. But it hurts my neck.
Now, listen to me, Joey. Before you find as nice a girl as Minerva, you'll go a long way.
Yeah, that's just it, Dad. You go a long way to find Minerva.
So Malcolm likes Evelyn, Evelyn likes Malcolm, and you like Evelyn.
Yeah, Dad, it's the eternal triangle.
Oh, no, son, you're forgetting Minerva. That's a rectangle.
Yeah, Dad, I guess you're right. It's got me going around in circles. Minerva?
Joey, come on in.
Thanks.
I haven't seen you in a week, Joey.
Hey, you've grown in that week, haven't you, Minerva?
Just a half inch.
Oh, a half inch.
I'm sorry, Joey.
Can't you do anything about it?
I don't think so. At night, instead of stretching my legs, I sort of fold them under.
Yeah, I guess you have to. Well, sit down, Minerva.
I am sitting, Joey.
Oh. Well, I stopped by to ask how you'd like to go on a date Saturday.
Oh, Joey.
A picnic.
A picnic?
To Maple Grove.
Oh, it's beautiful out there.
Yeah, a double date, Minerva.
Oh, double date?
Is that okay?
Evelyn?
Evelyn and Malcolm.
I see.
Malcolm's my friend, and the only way he can get to see Evelyn is when I call for her.
And the only way you can get to see Evelyn is on a double date.
Oh, the picnic was Malcolm's idea. You know, he's good at botany and all that stuff. So a picnic in the woods will give him a chance to show off in front of Evelyn.
I see.
But jeepers, can you imagine Evelyn listening to botany?
No, Joey, I can't. Joey.
Yeah?
You don't like tall girls, do you?
Oh, sure I do, Minerva.
You do?
Of course. You know what, Minerva?
What?
If I had another sister, I'd like her to be you.
Sister?
Yeah.
Sister?
Yeah.
That's very sweet, Joey.
Well, then I'll call for you Saturday afternoon, okay?
All right, Joey.
I'll see you then.
Oh, Joey.
Yeah?
I'll wear low heels.
Oh, yeah. Minerva.
Yes, Joey?
You couldn't... I mean, I don't suppose you could go in your sock feet, huh, Minerva?
I'm sorry, Joey.
I just love to hear you talk.
She just loves to hear him talk.
Look at this tree, Evelyn.
Are you having a good time, Joey?
Yeah.
What's the name of this tree, Malcolm?
One of the most beautiful of our Native American trees, hickory.
Oh, Malcolm, you know so much. You make me feel like a little dunce.
Oh, now, Evelyn, don't say that. You have a very receptive mind.
My goodness. That's the first time anyone ever told me I had a mind. I mean, a receptive mind.
Those greenish flowers are followed by large green fruit, which split open to reveal the nuts.
Oh, I just love to hear you talk, Malcolm. Did you hear what he said, Minerva?
Yes, large green fruit.
Did you hear what he said, Joey?
Yeah, nuts.
Careful, that branch is low.
Yeah, duck, Minerva.
I am ducking, Joey.
Evelyn, look. Look there, in that bush.
Oh, it's a bird's nest.
I think it's a chipping sparrow's nest.
Really, Malcolm?
See, the nest is made of grass and root fibers, and it's probably lined with horsehair.
Oh, Malcolm, I just love to hear you talk.
If it is a chipping sparrow's nest, the eggs are greenish-blue with cinnamon markings.
But the nest is way up there in that bush, Malcolm.
If we could see the eggs, then we'd be quite certain.
They're greenish-blue with cinnamon markings.
Can see them.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, Joey.
Evelyn, give me your hand. We'll run over there. Oh, look at that clump of bushes.
Oh, how lovely.
It looks like a winged burning bush. Come on, Evelyn.
Oh, Malcolm, you're simply wonderful.
Joey.
She isn't bored. She thinks he's wonderful. I don't know about trees and bushes and chipping sparrows.
But you know about a lot of other things.
Name one.
Well, maybe you can't point out things in the woods, Joey, but I'll bet if a girl got lost in the woods, why, I'll bet you'd come to her rescue.
Her rescue?
I'll bet you would, Joey.
Her rescue?
Hey, Joey, don't we turn here to go to Maple Grove?
Yeah. Wait a minute, Malcolm.
We turn to the left from Maple Grove, Joey.
And to the right is the place Dad and I go fishing.
To the right?
Yeah. If we turn there, we'd never get to Maple Grove. We'd be lost.
Joey.
I mean, it looked like we were lost, but I could find our way home.
You could?
I could rescue Evelyn.
Oh.
Then she'd forget about botany. Then she'd forget about Malcolm, wouldn't she, Minerva?
Why?
Wouldn't she?
I think Evelyn would be very impressed if you rescued her, Joey.
Sure.
Where do we turn, Joey?
Why,
The left is Maple Grove, Joey.
Turn to the right, Malcolm. Turn to the right.
The first time In front of a microphone was an audition when I was 11 years old in 1932 for a radio serial to emanate from San Francisco to match a corresponding origination from New York, because at that time there was no transcontinental radio. The program was called Wheatonville. The star was Tom Hutchinson, who played my father. His name in the show was Billy Batchelor, and I was Peter Batchelor. I had a twin sister named Pam. My uncle was played by Hal Perry, and he was my Uncle Hannibal. And the other person in the cast was a woman who later played Little Orphan Annie. Her name was Bobby Dean Maxwell, the wife of Ted Maxwell, who later wrote a program that was the highest rated program in the coast, called Hawthorne House, and was the competition for One Man's Family, which leads me into an interesting thought. Most of my life, it seems that I've almost been like Avis, because Hawthorne House never attained the real national popularity of One Man's Family, for which I had been deeply considered. The fact that, and this is not sour grapes by any means, because the gentleman of whom I'm going to speak went on and was irreplaceable and was much better than I ever would have been in the part, but Paige Gilman was the son of Don Gilman, who owned or was the vice president of KGO in San Francisco at the time that One Man's Family was being put together. Paige got the part and did it for many, many years. And I went ultimately into the competition for One Man's Family called Hawthorne House. And then if we want to skip now to 1940 and the advent of the show that I ultimately ended up doing in Chicago, which was kind of more like my own show, it was called That Booster Boy. That show was created to supply competition to the Aldrich family, which had begun in 1938, I believe, as an offspring of the Kate Smith Hour. They did their trial run on the Kate Smith Hour with Ezra, and I'm not sure if Jackie Kelko or Noman Tokar was on first. I can't remember, because I was working out of Chicago at the time, and they were in New York. So even though we ultimately ended up outrating the Aldrich family in the Nielsens, we never really attained their national popularity. And Ezra Stone, of course, who played Henry Aldrich, there were reports that emanated from New York that he wondered who this usurper was from Chicago, who not only was, in quotes, usurping his funny voice, but even had a last name with Stone in it. But Ezra and I ultimately met last year at a party at Lloyd Nolan's house, given for the Julia cast with Diane Carroll. And we were, after all of these years, you know, of knowing about each other and never really having met, it was really terribly interesting for us to shake hands and meet. I became the fair-haired boy of San Francisco radio until my lifelong friend Sam Edwards came to town to challenge me. But I did the number, again, as I told you, the number two Avis thing with Hawthorne House for 3 years, and shows like Winning the West and Death Valley Days.
Morning bugle call of the covered wagon trains dies away among the echoes. Another true story of Death Valley Days is brought to you by the Pacific Coast Borax Company,
who give you also the miracle of borax in two convenient forms. 20 Mule Team Borax for household and laundry use, and Boraxo for toilet use. And now for our evening's yarn. Where are you, old ranger?
Right here. Good evening, folks. Howdy. Well, now, I promised you last week that tonight I'd tell you the story of Pete Kitchen.
The Arizona pioneer whom the Apaches couldn't scare.
Oh, so you remember, do you?
I'll say.
I think I've gone through 3, 4, 5, 6 old rangers of Death Valley days, including television, which I've done many of. And but I must have been in the first or second year of the Death Valley Days series. Now, I can't remember whether Death Valley Days started in 1929, 30, or 31, but somewhere in there. And I first began to work it in 1932. But it was at that time, in about 1939, that Ted Maxwell and Bobby Dean Maxwell, his wife, had been in Chicago until 19... Oh, it's, you're asking me to go back so far now. But anyway, they had been in Chicago writing... Ted wrote... Well, I thought it was Lights Out. No, it wasn't Lights Out. Yes, it was. It was. He did write some for Lights Out, I believe. And Bobby Dean Maxwell played Little Orphan Annie for a season. She replaced, I believe, the original Little Orphan Annie. And I don't know why. Whether it was salary disputes or personality clash, I have no idea. But Bobby Maxwell played Little Orphan Annie for a while. At that time, I think she was 30, 35 years old. And but Ted was the writer. Ted Maxwell was the writer of Hawthorne House, and in Chicago he had made contact with Erna Phillips, even at that time the queen of the soaps. And Erna came to California and sold 3 or 4 of us on the show into going to Chicago, and I went into I left to Hawthorne House along with Ted and Bobby, and a fellow named Montgomery Moon Masters, whose son is a fellow named Mike Masters. And Monty was an assistant director at Warner Brothers, and he died just recently, and his wife Natalie was in San Francisco radio and played opposite Jack Webb, I believe, in a lot of things that in Jack's early life. Jack came to San Francisco after I had left. He began, I believe it was the Pier 13, I'm not sure. But that was after I had left in 1939. And anyway, the three of us went to Chicago into Woman White, which was one of the soap operas of the day. This was 1939. And within a year of that time, or a year and a half, I guess, of that time, I, after again having fortune smile on me, after a rough year in Chicago, actually, we only were involved in Woman in White for about 3 months, and then there was a change there. I was written out of the show, and whether Ted stayed on or not, it's very vague. All I know is that I was alone in Chicago with Monty Masters, and we lived in the Lawson YMCA, and then began one of the real lonely fights of my life, whether to stick it out or not, which I ultimately did, and Monty didn't. Monty came back to San Francisco and then moved to L.A., but I stuck it out, and Monty made a great mistake. If he'd stuck it out just a while longer, I think he would have been one of the three top leading men in Chicago radio. And the two top at that time were Johnny Hodiak and Bob Bailey. Billy Idelson got $27 a week for Vic and Sade. Well, he was a peasant, because I was getting $35 for Wheatinaville. But, of course, Hal Perry was getting 60, which I didn't know at the time. If I'd known at the time, I didn't find this out until about 30 years later that Hal was making 60. But then Hal had started, Hal and Nelson Case, who was the announcer, had started a couple of years ahead of me. Although, you know, you go back past 1932 and there wasn't much radio to begin with. You'd have to go back to Schenectady, I think, in 1925. Now, I think Arthur Godfrey had begun at that time, but there aren't that many of us still floating around who antedate 1932. But I know I did a local show in San Francisco where I was a junior news reporter. And I know I got $15 for that, but then I did a public appearance, and I got $2.50 for that. And the NBC Artist Service took 10%. They took a quarter out of my salary at that time. But that was what eventually caused the formation of the Union of AFRA, because NBC not only owned you and had you under contract, but they took 10% of your salary also. And then I did an audition of Harold Teen at WGN in Chicago at the same time that I did a show on Knickerbocker Playhouse, which is an anthology series on NBC at that time, in which Johnny Hodiak and Bob Bailey were primarily the two leading men, and they had some marvelous writers on that show. And the people who ultimately wrote my radio show, that Brewster Boy, wrote a family show for Knickerbocker Playhouse, which we did, and it was so successful that they were asked to write a sequel to it. Well, that ultimately became that Brewster Boy, but I have every reason to believe it was hastened along by the success of the Aldrich family, whereas success breeds its copiers. And I have the feeling that this was not just coincidental. But I began to get laughs at that time, and it gets... Then, of course, that Brewster Boy was an audience show, and to be able to make people laugh every week became a very heady thing. And that Brewster Boy began very slowly on NBC. We ran for 39 weeks and built continually until when I left, it was in the top 10 of the Nielsen, and we outrated our competition, which at the time was Jimmy Durante and Gary Moore, when I left anyway. And Brewster Boy ended for me in 1943. I was replaced by Arnold Stang to begin with. And then there was one other replacement after Arnold, and then Dick York, who starred for many years on Bewitched, took my place. And then in 1945, an incident arose of which I was not aware. I was overseas at the time, in which that Brewster Boy was suddenly bought out or taken away from the original owners, and the cast all moved over, with only one exception, I believe, to a new show called Those Websters, and a fellow by the name of Gil Stratton took my place. After the war, after I came back out of the service, then the show... Well, I got letters from the East, from the advertising agency, saying they were thinking of moving the show back west again, and would I be interested? I said, fine. So the show moved west under the name of Those Websters with Willie Waterman, who ultimately, after that, replaced Hal Perry in The Great Gildersleeve. Willie Waterman played my father. And Billy Idelson and I both came back into the show, and was written by Frank and Doris Hursley now at this time, who have now ultimately and since become the kind of the, along with Erna Phillips, the king of the television soap operas.
Well, Joey has resorted to drastic measures to win the love of little Evelyn White. He's deliberately directed his friends along a path which he alone knows, so that he can have the pleasure of rescuing them. At the moment, the elements seem to have taken matters out of Joey's hands. The sun's gone in and the wind sprung up and there's rain in the air. And the four picnickers stumbling through the woods have a lost and bedraggled look.
We'd better find our way out of the woods before it storms.
If we don't, we may be struck by lightning.
Oh!
Now, there's nothing to worry about. Just put yourselves in my hands. The pages of history are filled with stories of children who perished in the woods.
Oh, I don't want to perish in the woods.
Now, Evelyn, I'll take care of you. Just follow me.
Perhaps we'll meet a wolf, like Romulus and Remus.
A wolf?
Recall, they lived on wolf's milk. Jeepers, I don't think I'd like wolf's milk.
Well, then, we'll starve. And next month, our bones will lie bleaching in the sun.
Oh, I don't want my bones to lie bleaching in the sun.
Now, Evelyn, he's just trying to scare you. There's nothing to worry about. Trust me. I'll get you out of here.
Joey.
Yeah, Minerva?
Do you know which way we're walking?
Oh, of course I know which way we're walking. This way.
I mean, which direction?
Which direction?
He doesn't know.
Obviously not.
Now, don't get excited. There's nothing to worry about. Of course I know which way we're walking. We're walking, east.
East? Are you sure?
Of course I'm sure. When you face north, east is on your right.
It is?
Why, certainly. Anybody who knows anything about the wide open spaces, anybody who's lived a rugged life knows that when you face north, east is on your right.
On your right, Joey?
Yeah, on your right. Or is it on your left?
But how do you know when you're facing north?
I beg your pardon?
He doesn't know. Obviously, he's confused.
I'm not confused. Mother Nature's guiding me. I know by the moss on the trees. Moss grows on the north side of trees. Anybody who's read about Indians and stuff knows that moss grows on the north side of trees.
On the north side?
Sure, on the north side. Or is it on the south?
My feet hurt.
Now, Evelyn.
Oh, my goodness, why shouldn't my feet hurt? We've been walking for miles and miles.
Minerva isn't uttering one complaint about her feet hurting.
Yeah, and she's got more to hurt.
Joey.
Yeah, Minerva?
How do you know we'll get home if we walk east?
How do I know we'll... Oh, yeah, of course. Why, well, there's the river over there, and way over there is the top of Arrowhead Hill.
Yes, Joey?
Well.
Oh, look. Look, everybody. It's clearing up. Now the sun's shining.
Oh, of course the sun's shining. I told you I'd take care of everything.
Yes, you did, Joey.
Just follow me. Come on, Minerva.
My shoes are killing me. I've got to take them off.
You'll probably tear your feet to ribbons.
Joey.
Yeah, Minerva?
Which way did you say we were walking?
East.
East. Joey.
Yeah, Minerva?
Look at the sun.
What about the sun?
It's going down in the north.
In the north?
I'm sorry, Joey.
Yay. We are lost.
Mother's terribly worried, isn't she, Daddy?
Well, now that your mother's gone to answer the phone, I'll admit I'm a little bit worried myself.
Yeah, pretty late for those kids to be out in the woods.
Oh, you know Joey. Forgets all about time.
Dad.
Yes, dear?
It was Mrs. White.
And Mrs. White?
And she said exactly what Mrs. Campbell said 5 minutes ago.
Yes, Mother.
They're furious because Malcolm's at the picnic and because Evelyn's there, too.
Uh-huh.
They blame Joey for bringing them together and they blame me for having raised Joey.
Well, maybe they've got something there.
You wanted the ladies to agree, Mrs. Brewster. They agree on that.
To hear them talk, you'd think there was nothing for me to do but withdraw from the club.
Good idea, Mother.
Sure, you can form your own club. The Every Other Tuesday Evening Literary Society.
Yeah, but you better be careful, Mother. There's only one Tuesday left.
Oh, that doesn't worry me. It's Joey. Where can he be?
It's getting so terribly late.
Well, now, don't worry. Don't worry. There's no reason to get excited. Joey will take care of everything.
Yeah, everything.
Jeepers, Minerva, we're lost. We'll never find our way out of the woods.
Oh, you'll do it, Joey.
Oh, Malcolm, look. Look behind that tree. What is
another tree.
I thought it was a wolf.
Evelyn, sometimes your charm wears thin.
Minerva.
Yes, Joey?
Doesn't this place look awfully familiar to you?
Well,
this is where we started from. We're going around in circles.
Joey?
Yeah, Minerva.
Didn't you say that was Arrowhead Hill?
Yeah, that's right.
And didn't you say that Arrowhead Hill is on the Northwest Highway?
Did I?
I thought you did.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, sure, I did.
Well, if the Northwest Highway is over there, we must be northeast of town. So all we have to do is turn to our right at that clearing and keep going straight ahead. Isn't that what you were thinking, Joey?
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
Joey, far be it from me to distrust a friend, but I think you're prevaricating.
Will you quit worrying? That's Arrowhead Hill over there, and it's on the Northwest Highway. So we must be northeast of town. All we have to do is turn to our right at that clearing and keep going straight ahead.
Oh, Joey, you're wonderful. Now, then, isn't Joey wonderful?
Maybe I'm prejudiced, but he leaves me cold.
Oh, I knew you'd save me, Joey. I knew you'd rescue me. Hear that, Joey? She's very impressed.
Huh?
Evelyn's impressed. That's what you wanted, isn't it, Joey?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's what I wanted, I guess.
It was wonderful the way you figured it out, Joey.
Figured what out?
How to find our way home. All about the highway and Arrowhead Hill and everything. It was wonderful of you, Joey.
It was?
Wonderful.
Yeah. Yeah, come to think of it, it was wonderful, wasn't it?
Joey, we've been frantic.
Son, where have you been?
What happened?
Why were you gone so long?
Hello, everybody.
Evelyn's mother's phoned 4 times.
But Dad...
And Malcolm's mother's phoned 5 times.
But Mom...
And I was just on my way to the police station.
Oh, but Phil...
Mother's been terribly upset. You should be ashamed of yourself.
But Nancy, I'll get the phone. I'll get it.
Two bits, it's Mrs. White or Mrs. Campbell. One or the other.
One or the other.
Joey, why were you so late?
Why did the picnic last so long?
Well... We sort of got lost, Dad.
Got lost?
Yeah. When you want to go east and keep going west, it takes a lot longer to get where you're going.
Well, how'd you finally get straightened out?
Oh, that was easy. I just put my mind to it.
And then how did you get straightened out?
I beg your pardon?
Oh, Joey. Joey, you're wonderful, dear.
Yeah, Mom, I know.
Now what, Mother?
It was Mrs. White. Evelyn told her they were lost in the woods and Joey rescued them.
Yeah, he's just been telling us, Mother.
But that's not all. They were so worried about the children that they forgot their quarrel.
Well, I'm glad to hear that, Mother.
And that's not all.
What else, Mother?
They're very pleased with Joey and they're very pleased with me for having raised him.
Well, we do deserve a lot of credit.
You can say that again.
And that's not all.
What else, Mother?
And because they're so pleased with me, who do you suppose they're going to make chairman of the Every Other Tuesday Evening Literary Society?
I can't guess. Tell us.
Why, me. They're going to make me chairman.
Oh, Mother, that's wonderful.
Well, come on, let's go in the living room.
Oh, such excitement.
Mother's going to be chairman. Phil, aren't you surprised?
Surprised? I'm dumbfounded.
Dad, please, wait a minute.
What is it, son?
Dad, don't you think that a fellow should be willing to make any sacrifice for his friend?
Why, that all depends, Joey.
Well, you know, I told you that Malcolm is very fond of Evelyn.
Yes, I remember, the eternal triangle.
Yeah, but that's just it, Dad. I'm willing to step aside for Malcolm's sake.
For Malcolm's sake?
Yes, sir.
Oh, Evelyn didn't show up so well on the picnic, did she, son?
Well, she... Don't you think a fella should be willing to make any sacrifice for his friend?
Mm-hmm. You don't want to take Evelyn to the dance Saturday night, hmm?
Well, Minerva was a very good sport. I think she deserves a reward.
A reward? Going with you?
Yeah, Dad.
A reward.
I guess I'll call Minerva, Dad.
All right, son. Then join us in the living room.
Yes, sir. Maple 712, please. Yes, ma'am. Ah, jeepers, Minerva's going to be a very happy girl, I'll bet.
Hello?
Oh, hello, Minerva. This is Joey.
Oh, Joey.
Minerva, about the dance at the gym Saturday night.
Yes, Joey?
Well, I've decided to take you.
Me? Oh, Joey.
I know. I know.
But, Joey, I have a date.
What?
Malcolm's taking me to the dance.
Malcolm?
He said he'd let you take Evelyn.
Me take Evelyn? Yikes.
I'm sorry, Joey.
The people all still live here, and most of them still are in the business, although Hugh Studebaker may have retired by now. I'm not positive. He played my father, and Connie Crowder played my mother. Jane Webb played my sweetheart, Minerva. Louise Fitch, who was working in motion pictures and stage, played my sister. And I mentioned Bob Bailey, who played my brother-in-law. And Bobby Jellison played my best friend, Wendy. Bobby still works, but he's more or less retiring. And Jerry Spellman, who played my pal Pee-wee. I'd lost track of Jerry after the war, and have no idea where Jerry is, although he may be around somewhere. I really don't know. But we were a well, close-knit group, and we had a lovely family relationship in the show. And Ezra, at the party, told me that he felt that our show had developed a much better family relationship and closer and was less hokey in some respects than his own show, which I thought was very nice of him to say. I don't necessarily buy that, because I think the Aldrich family really in its day was one of the landmarks in the entertainment business, and I loved it. I thought that he and Jackie Kelk and Norman were just marvelous. The whole group were, but we were good too. We were very good for a copy. For Avis, we were very good, and we did try harder. I think we started at the Merchandise Mart, and then ultimately did the Wrigley Building, and we had to do. Like every other show in that day, we had to do two shows on Friday night. We did an early show and a late show. We broadcast out of CBS, which I always remember from the same studio that Glenn Miller used to do his show from. And I got to meet the Miller band and the organization, and Ray Eberly was one of my big fans, and his children were there during the war. I know I heard from Ray several times. And Glenn Miller had gone to school with the producer, director of our show. And this was a terribly well-organized show. We rehearsed, though, only one day ahead. We rehearsed early in the week so the writers could rewrite, which is still followed today in television. I know I did the Dick Van Dyke show, the third one that was ever done, and the one that won the Emmy for the show and for John Rich, the director. And they followed almost the same procedure. They rehearse the show for the following week, a week ahead of time, so the writers can hear it at the table and then rewrite around a conference table. And we did that in those days, too. And then, of course, we were, by that time, you know, we were so professional that we did the show in 3 hours, and we didn't need that much. We rehearsed 3 hours, maybe, and that was it. I mean, you got to remember, you were reading, you weren't memorizing, and we were very good. And it used to be a thrill to see the audiences line up, and at that time, I was I was kind of it in Chicago, and I was kind of the teenage idol of those days. There was no Elvis Presley and no Beatles. There was just squeaky me. And I used to get, of course, I was, look, you're talking about one of the lucky people of all time, and I was living, I was going to college, I had a car, I was spoiled rotten. From the moment it began, I was something special, and I wouldn't do it again. I wouldn't allow it to be done to me again. I would not do it to my child or children. And I think that any parent who does, I don't care how great the financial gains are right now, is ultimately doing a disservice to his or her children by pushing them in. I have never known all my life, and I've been, you know, I am now in the 40th year of making my living, and there aren't that many, you know, with my longevity. You may put them on two hands and two feet that have gone that long without doing anything else. But even and no matter what it has brought me, and all the acclaim and happiness and a degree of money, and sometimes not at all, I have never known what I might have done if I had made the choice. And it'll never be erased from my mind that I was dropped into this situation, and it's like a disease. Once you have it, you cannot quit. You cannot quit. You hang on with bare fingernails once you've had a taste of it. And I really don't think it's the roar of the grease paint and the smell of the crowd kind of thing, that it's... Well, of course, later when I began to make people laugh, and then particularly on the stage, after I had learned how to act, finally, after making my living for 15 years after the war, I suddenly realized that I didn't know how to act at all, because radio was certainly not a training ground for films or the stage. Very few people made the transition from radio to stage and film. But luckily, I was pushed into a school and a marvelous situation where I had 2 years of training with the finest artists in the world, I believe. And they saved my life as far as longevity in the business goes. I've had a life lucky beyond compare. There's only one guy in this whole world, it seems to me, who might... maybe two, maybe Billy Idelson and Richard Crenna, who were my contemporaries from the time we were all 11, 12, 14 years old. Billy and I began ahead of Dick only because Dick is 4 or 5 years younger. But, you know, when you consider all of the marvelous things that each of us have had happen to us in our lives, you know, Dick is on his way to becoming a really major motion picture and television star, and Billy is, as I had wanted him to do for a long time and urged him to do, has become one of the finest writers in the business. He won the Writers Guild Award. I've traveled, I've made films out of the country, out of it. I've had acclaim on Broadway. I've had the best that a person can have out of it, and yet I still don't know what I really would have done if I had made the choice.
You do? I don't?
Definitely not.
Boy, Hen, I hope you're right. I've been saving for 2 months to get a new band for my wristwatch, and now if I had to... Suppose she expects me to.
She couldn't.
How do you know?
I'll bet Agnes doesn't even know it's the anniversary of your first date with
her. What I wanted to tell Ezra Stone, when we met was that I hadn't stolen his voice at all in 1940. That I'd been doing that thing, that cracked voice of mine had been making people laugh in out of San Francisco from 1935 on. I think I began it in Hawthorne House, where my voice began to crack at 15 or 16. And it wasn't anything that I'd stolen from Ezra Stone or Henry Ulrich. The show ran for me until 1943. I was at Northwestern University at that time, and I had already enlisted in the Marine Corps and the Reserve. And so I was on borrowed time from April 1942 until June 1943. And they wanted to get me deferred and out. And that was too patriotic a time to accept that for me. What I would do now is another thing, I don't know. But at that time, I couldn't wait, and my ego wouldn't allow me to wait, and so I went. Why the Marine Corps, I will never know. Heaven only knows that I had no business there. I came out a captain and was lucky to be alive, and I had an incident during the war, which was absolutely shocking, involving Billy Idelson from Vic and Sade. And Billy had played my best buddy on Brewster Boy for the first 26 weeks. And then Bill had already been enlisted in the Navy Air Force. And he went ahead of me. And we both ended up at D-Day at Okinawa. I was on board a ship, and I was the Marine officer on board an attack transport, and Billy was in the Naval Air Force, flying F-6F, Grumman F-6F, or a night fighter. I'm not sure which he was fighting at the time, but I do know that the first day, D-Day at Okinawa, there was no opposition. We came in there in the morning. We had ridden in through a typhoon. There was no opposition on the beach. The first 10 wounded we had back on our ship had all been shot by our own people. And everybody was trigger happy. There were about 1,500 ships in Buckner Bay waiting for the Japanese Air Force to come. And at dusk, three planes appeared in the sky, and we all went to condition red. And we got an order to hold our fire, that there was a possibility they were our planes. Now, I was in command of two 40-millimeter batteries on the bow of this attack transport. And all of a sudden, I saw the tracers begin to light up the sky at dusk. And I looked up, and there were these three planes. Well, from that distance, just eyeballing, you couldn't tell whether they were ours or theirs. Well, they were our planes, and one of them was Billy Idelson. And we did not fire. We held our fire, but there were 1,500 ships in that harbor letting fly every tracer they had at those three planes of ours, none of which we hit. Absolutely none of which we hit. And we immediately got word from the commander of Naval Air that if we ever did that again, he would pull all air cover completely out of the area. But when I think that if my battery had been firing and there was the possibility that I could have knocked down my very best friend, it just makes a very small world.
Yes, Joey.
Marv, what did the woman say when she found her husband out in the kitchen talking with the domestic help?
I don't know, Joey. What did the woman say when she found her husband out in the kitchen talking with the domestic help?
Now you're gassing with Cook. get him, Mark.
Oh, that's Joey. That Bruce. Hey, wait a minute. Hey, wait a minute. Something's wrong here. You're not Joey Brewster.
Oh, yes, I am.
Oh, no, you're not.
Well, I can prove it.
Oh, no, you can prove it.
Sure, ask Dad.
Well, that's fair enough. Jim Brewster.
Yes, Mama.
This young man is trying to play a new trick on old dog me. He says he's Joey.
Oh, hello, Joey.
Hi, Dad.
You mailed that letter I gave you?
Yep, it's in the grill.
Are you trying to tell me this is your son, Joey Brewster?
Well, I'm not trying to tell you anything, Marv. This is my son.
But, Jim, that's Joey over there.
No. That's Eddie Firestone Jr. over there. Oh, now, wait a minute.
Joey.
Joey, come here.
Who? Me, sir? Do you want me, sir?
Oh, he always called me Marv. Say, who are you? Aren't you... What is your name?
Eddie Firestone Jr. of the United States Marine Corps.
Then you're not Joey Brewster?
That's me, Marv, over here.
Well, for the love of Mud, will somebody tell me who's who around here? I'm going crazy.
And I'm going into the Marines. In fact, I'm in. I report for active duty any day. And I'm going to play the part of Joey Brewster. Right, Dad?
That's right, son. Starting next week.
At last, the light seeps through. I begin to understand. You're Joey Brewster.
That's right, Marv.
The new Joey Brewster. And you're Eddie Firestone Jr., the old Joey Brewster, who's now in the Marines.
That's right, sir. Private Eddie Firestone Jr. of the Marine Corps.
Private Eddie Firestone Jr.
Yes, Private Eddie Firestone Jr. Eddie, I hate to see you go. We'll all miss you. Mrs. Brewster, Minerva, Nancy, and Pee-wee, your friends at the Quaker Oats Club.
I hate to leave you, but...
Yes, I know. You're 22 years old. You enlisted the moment you came of age. And you've been itching to report for active duty ever since.
Yes, sir.
Well,
bye, Eddie boy.
Good luck, and God bless you, son.
Thank you, sir. And I'll do my best pinch hitting for you on the show, Eddie.
Well, you'll do a swell job, Arnold. I know it.
Oh, and Eddie.
Yes, sir?
Here's something to take with you. From a man at the Quaker Oats Company. It's an official Marine wristwatch. I'll read the words on the back. It says to Eddie Firestone, our Brewster boy, from the Quakers.
Oh, gee, that's swell of them.
And incidentally, the Quakers are all here in the studio tonight. They want to tell you goodbye, too. Mr. Stewart, Mr. Douglas, Mr. Holly, Mr. Stone, Mr. Compton.
Oh, well, I'll step over right now and see him.
Just one moment more, Eddie. There's another gentleman here in the studio who would like to see you first.
Someone else?
Yes. One of your superior officers is here in the studio, Eddie.
One of my what, sir?
One of your superior officers. Colonel Chester L. Fortney, officer in charge of Central Procurement Division for the 16 states of the Middle Western area. Ladies and gentlemen, the Brewster cast and Eddie, may I present Colonel Chester Fortney.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. We are glad to have Private Firestone as one of our number. I know he will be a credit to the Corps. I know your millions of listeners will miss hearing your voice, but they will derive inspiration from your performances under a new sponsor, the United States Marine.
Next Friday, same time, same station, for another enjoyable evening with That Brewster Boy, written by Pauline Hopkins and starring Arnold Stang.
Reminiscing, I feel you near. Once more, you're my love.
yesteryear.
Be with us next week for another nostalgic look at radio of yesteryear.
And now it's just about time we were picking up our members and moving along our way. I hope you've enjoyed listening to these songs and the memories that go with them as much as I've enjoyed bringing them to you. And I'll be keeping my weather eye peeled, yes, sir, looking for you all to join us the next time we drop around this way for a friendly little get-together. And I hope that'll be real soon, folks. And until then, this is your old friend Singing Sam saying goodbye for now.
Same Time, Same Station is produced for KRLA News and Public Affairs by John Price, associate producer Cam Currier, special research by Martin Halperin, and I'm Bill Browning. Our thanks to Eddie Firestone for guesting tonight and for the Brewster Boyd transcriptions, which were a part of this program.
Be sure to be with us next week at this same time, same station.